Our reading this morning is an excerpt from A Mercy, which is a novel by Toni Morrison, who died this past summer. This novel is set in the 1680s in what would become New York, Maryland, and Virginia. And in this scene, Lena, an enslaved indigenous woman who survived recent settler colonialist violence that destroyed her community, is telling a story to young Florence, an enslaved girl who survived the Middle Passage from Angola. Lena is like a mother to the orphaned Florence, and Florence is like a daughter to the childless Lena. Here is the story that Lena tells. One day, an eagle laid her eggs in a nest far above and far beyond the snakes and paws that hunted them. Her eyes are midnight black and shiny as she watches over them. At the tremble of a leaf, the scent of any other life, her frown deepens. Her head jerks and her feathers quietly lift. Her talons are sharpened on rock. Her beak is like the scythe of a war god. She is fierce, protecting her born and young. One day, a traveler climbs a mountain nearby. He stands at its summit, admiring all he sees below him: the turquoise lake, the eternal hemlocks, the birds sailing into clouds cut by rainbow. The traveler laughs at the beauty, saying, "This is perfect! This is mine!" And the world swells. The word swells, booming like thunder into valleys, over acres of primrose and mallow. Creatures come out of caves, wondering what it means. Mine, mine, mine. The shells of the eagle's eggs quiver, and one even cracks. The eagle swivels her head to find the source of the strange, meaningless thunder, the incomprehensible sound. Spotting the traveler, she swoops down to claw away his laugh and his unnatural sound. But the traveler, under attack, raises his stick and strikes her wing with all his strength. Screaming, she falls and falls over the turquoise lake, beyond the eternal hemlocks, down through the clouds cut by rainbow. Screaming, screaming, she is carried away by wind instead of wing. Then Florence whispered, "Where is she now?" "Still falling," Lena would answer. "She is falling forever." Florence barely breathes. "And the eggs?" she asks. "They hatch alone," says Lena. "Do they live?" Florence's whispering is urgent. "We have," says Lena. My first season as a farmer, I worked at Drumlin Farm in Lincoln. I lived in a little cabin on a lake and watched the sun rise over the rows of crops I harvested each morning. Because of the shape of the land there and the rich, clayey soil, there was no need for irrigation in the vegetable fields at Drumlin. The rain drained down the Drumlin that gives Drumlin Farm its name and fed the groundwater in the fields below, and everything stayed well watered. Well, unless there was a drought. For the first week or so of no rain, I was happy. The sky was blue and clear. The air was dry. The weather was gorgeous. I wore my sunglasses and sunblock, my big hat, and I was delighted to be free of mud and muck, delighted that there was no drenching rain soaking my back and freezing my fingers during the hours of weeding and harvesting. After a couple of weeks went by, the bright sun and clear skies were no longer so cheerful. They were more like a straightforward fact above our heads. We had held off on planting because to plant without water, you may imagine, is no good for seeds and seedlings. But enough time had passed and we needed to get back on schedule and plant some new crops. So we drove giant tanks of water around in the back of our pickup trucks, dunking watering cans in and hand-watered each little plant after putting it in the ground. Our work days stretched long into the late summer twilight to accommodate this extra work. 6 weeks later, still no rain. The fields were dusty and tired. I was dusty and tired. Somehow, many of our crops still bore fruit. The land kept producing, and we did our best to add water. Each day, under those cloudless skies, I felt the fullness of my reliance upon the earth and the rain. That summer, living in my cabin by the lake, coaxing my food from the land, and on my knees, begging for rain, I had the chance to live on the earth not as if it belongs to me, but as if I belong to it. It is only because of the rain and the earth that I exist, that any of us exists. That was more than 10 years ago now. Now I live in an apartment and I can go weeks without getting my toes on the ground. I get most of my produce from the grocery store, rarely making it to the farmer's market despite my best intentions. Moving through my everyday life, through the built environment we humans have created, it is easy to forget my connection to the land. Easy to think we humans merely live on the earth, or even that we own the earth. It is easy to forget that we are part of the earth. After all, we are of a culture whose primary origin story includes this instruction from God to Adam and Eve. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the birds and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Dominance of the earth and, terribly enough, so often other people is the principle that underpins much of our economy, our infrastructure, our way of life. Toni Morrison writes of dominance as appearing in the form of a traveler who shouts, "Mine!" And then she describes the traumatic shock this unleashes upon the landscape and its creatures. The eagle mother falls and falls. Her babies are orphaned. Morrison's story is of indigenous trauma and survival in the early years of American settler colonialism, and the trauma and survival of enslaved Africans. And it has a message for all of humanity, too. We have inherited a wound, a rift between us and the land. The separation that can grow from this claim of ownership over the land, rather than the wholeness that can come from living in the knowledge that we are of it. Margaret Atwood has a poem that speaks to this called "The Moment." I'd like to share the whole poem with you now. The moment when, after many years of hard work and a long voyage, you stand in the center of your room, house, half acre, square mile, island, country, knowing at last how you got there, and say, "I own this," is the same moment when the trees unloose their soft arms from around you. The birds take back their language, the cliffs fissure and collapse. The air moves back from you like a wave, and you can't breathe. "No," they whisper, "you own nothing. You were a visitor time after time, climbing the hill, planting the flag, proclaiming, 'We never belonged to you. You never found us. It was always the other way round.'" During my time as an urban farmer, I attended a workshop at Knoll Farm in Vermont with others working at the intersection of land and people. When I arrived, I found a laminated sheet orienting me to the place. In addition to directions to the bathroom, it described the origin of Lake Champlain and the mountain ranges that surround it, according to the first peoples of that land, the Abenaki. Here is one account of that story. Tabaldok, the creator, made the world, and Odzihozo, the man who made himself, created the Champlain Valley. Before he had legs, Odzihozo dragged himself around, gouging out the Champlain Valley and the river valleys in the land's surface. He piled up the dirt with his hands to build the Adirondack, Green, and Taconic Mountains. Finally, he made Lake Champlain and was so satisfied with his work that he decided to stay there forever. Climbing up on a bedrock knob in the middle of the lake, Odzihozo transformed himself into a rock. The Abenaki call this rock the Guardian's Rock, and for generations they have left offerings of tobacco there. The Abenaki's story of their land echoes the story that may be more familiar to us, that the Champlain Valley and surrounding landscape was formed by the last retreating glaciers some 10,000 years ago. There is evidence of human life in Champlain Valley from 12,000 years ago. What I'm saying is, the story that the Abenaki still tell of how their homelands were formed reads like they were there. These lands are theirs, and they are of these lands. In the words of Abenaki authors Hilda Robstoy, Dee Brightstar, Tom Obomsawin, and John Moody, here's what they said. Our life began with the creation and transformation of this land, passed down to countless generations in the oral tradition. Our life, the life of the grasses and trees, marshes and fields, forests, is connected to us, as all human beings are joined to our mothers by the umbilical cord, as trees and plants are rooted in the soil. I got an email this week from Cole by Gail Forsyth Vale, who is the director of Lifespan Faith Engagement. So that's sort of like all the RE programs, all the faith formation programs of our Unitarian Universalist Association. And in this article, she wrote about the wholeness that truth-telling can offer us. The occasion for her message was Indigenous Peoples Day, which many observe as opposed to Columbus Day. She wrote, part of the spiritual work we must do is face all of our story, even the parts we would rather skip. There's a picture of me on the wall downstairs here in the vestry with a goofy smile on my face and a 2-month-old on my chest. Some of you may have seen that picture. We put it up for the open house and it's still there, which is delightful. So that picture was taken at the march against the alt-right and white supremacy in Boston that happened in August 2017. When I got to the march, someone handed me a sign that said, "You are standing on stolen land." I was uncomfortable at first holding this sign. It seemed very finger-waggy. What can I do with that information other than feel unbearably guilty? Perhaps if it had said, "I am standing on stolen land," it would have been less accusational and more a statement of a difficult but plain fact. Boston is occupied Shawmut. This is Massachusetts and Wampanoag territory. My sign also brought into stark relief how deeply absurd and arrogant the alt-right's xenophobic and racist nationalism is. A wall. Travel bans, immigration raids and deportations. These are the policies of a nation who would clutch angrily and greedily at its claims to a continent, defining who is worthy of a place in our lands and who is not. By the end of the march, I was grateful for the lessons my sign had taught me. Its voice was prophetic. It challenged me to truly question my claims to the land. Gail Forsyth Vail encourages us to learn about and tell the truths of the lands where we live, to wholeheartedly support the Youth Climate Strike Coalition, which includes, among its demands, respect of Indigenous lands and sovereignty, and to reflect and prepare before the upcoming General Assembly of Unitarian Universalists, which some of you may know is going to take place in Providence. And this will be the 400th anniversary of the English colonists' arrival to Wampanoag lands. She writes, "Knowing and embracing more of the story, including the difficult parts, with humility and courage, makes us more faithful people." Just as it is healing to tell the truth about whose lands these are and how we came to inherit them, it is healing to recognize that we belong to the earth, that we are in relationship with the earth. As Unitarian Universalists, we covenant to respect the interdependent web of life of which we are all a part. It feels nice when we remember that. This principle does call us to something difficult, to live in tension with the engine that drives our economies and makes our everyday lives possible. Dominance of nature, consumerism, private property. How do we live out this principle, given the system that we live in? From an early age, our children must sort out what belongs to whom. June is studying hard on the word mine these days. One of the playgrounds in our neighborhood has a giant sandbox full of toys that people drop off when their kids are done with them. So when June objects to sharing a shovel or bucket in that particular sandbox, claiming, "Mine!" it's particularly ironic. It's not yours, hon. We are all like June in that sandbox, just trying to get by and hang on to our shovels. But really, they're not our shovels. We're just using them while we're here. And there are little cracks in this system. In addition to our noble but threatened public institutions and public open space, we experiment with small ways to share in a world where who owns what is paramount. We plant in community gardens. We browse little free libraries. This congregation shares food and clothes with the community freely and regularly in huge amounts. And this church itself, who owns it? We are stewards of this church for future generations. We dedicate this church to the mission we serve and to one another, to God, to all that we hold sacred. Church is where we practice caring for a place, not because we own it, but because it cares for us. And so we work for this church to be a place of belonging, where we understand that it does not belong to us, but that we belong to it. Maybe we only feel this sense of belonging fleetingly, a moment of comfort, a feeling of being held. Maybe we're still hoping for that feeling, still wondering if we might find it here. Or maybe we gulp big mouthfuls of belonging when we come here. However it is for us, let us continue striving to build a place where we all belong, a place where we can remember whose we are. Let us seek wholeness, tell the truths of this land, heal our relationships to the land. Let us continue growing our souls in such a way that we can live with one another on earth as if we belong to it and to one another, because we do. Amen. May it be so. For our prayer and meditation today, I'd like to offer some time to just breathe into a place you love on this earth. It is fall. The leaves are glowing golden and red. The waters are getting cooler. The air is getting crisper. Whatever little patch of earth you love, let it hold you. Let it be with you in your sorrow and in your joy. Offer your sorrow and your joy to it. Offer this big, old, generous earth your gratitude. Offer it your praise. Rest in this beautiful earth. Rest in the love of this congregation, surrounded as we are by one another and by the land. Our closing words this morning, "We Are All Longing to Go Home" by Starhawk. We are all longing to go home to some place we have never been. A place half remembered and half envisioned, we can only catch glimpses of from time to time. Community. Somewhere there are people to whom we can speak with passion without having the words catch in our throats. Somewhere a circle of hands will open to receive us. Eyes will light up as we enter. Voices will celebrate with us whenever we come into our own power. Community means strength that joins our strength to do the work that needs to be done. Arms to hold us when we falter. A circle of healing. A circle of friends. Someplace where we can be free. May this church be that place. Go in peace.